Welcome back to the Friday Happy Hour with Anne-Marie Kelly, and welcome Eileen Rockefeller-Growald. How are you doing, Eileen?
I'm doing great, Anne-Marie. Thank you for having me.
Oh, I'm so thrilled that you're here. You know, Eileen, if I hadn't heard you speak at the book signing at the Jessup Library, I wouldn't have understood what you were getting at with the title of your book, Being a Rockefeller, Becoming Myself. Now, if I recall, that wasn't your original title, but you came to embrace it and explained it beautifully that night. What happened with your original title, and why do you now really like that title, Being a Rockefeller, Becoming Myself?
Well, thank you for asking the question. Originally, the book was called Family Matters, Stories to Invite You Home. Hmm. But since I'm a first-time author, published author, I don't think that title would have really sold books, and my agent, being infinitely more wise than I, saw that it would be important to simply claim the Rockefeller part of me as much as the Eileen part. And he was spot on, because although it took me several months to be able to say the title without explaining it with some embarrassment, since it's part of my family culture to be a little more under the radar than this title would imply, being a Rockefeller was how I started off in life, and we all start off from one family or another. The task we each have is to become ourselves. So Being a Rockefeller, Becoming Myself was actually the best possible title to explain the journey of my life and the stories I've written within the book.
Well, that's really true. It's that we all seem to be searching for that person who really is who we really are. And, you know, in the earlier years, we're so shaped by whatever family we come in. And, you know, like whether it's a Rockefeller or in my case, it was the Chumakelli family, which is, you know, that name, you can understand why I shortened it to Kelly because it's about that long. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it doesn't matter where you come in. I'm sure my listeners can understand that same thing because we come from wherever our families were coming from. And, and you said something then, and you reiterated in your book that I really resonated, and I'll bet that my listeners will too, and that is that you felt like you didn't belong in your family, like with your siblings. What was it about your childhood that made you feel different?
Well, first of all, just to continue the thread about the family, you know, family really is our first mirror in our lives.
Oh,
unfortunately, that mirror is often inaccurate, and it doesn't reflect back to us the fullness of who we are. So what made me feel different was that I was naturally more emotional and more outwardly emotional, I should say, than my siblings. And this went against the grain both of the family I was born into and the time, the era, the 50s, the decade in which I was born into. One was not expected or supposed to sort of flare up with a temper or cry if you're upset. And of course, little children do, but I've always been one to just naturally put out front whatever I feel. And this was not accepted as the family culture. So in that way, I felt I didn't really belong. And I got labeled in ways that were not helpful to me, which everyone, I think, experiences in a family, their first mirror.
Yeah, in my family, Eileen, my siblings called me, "Oh, great child of the universe."
Oh, you know? Actually love that.
Well, I love it now.
Beautiful now.
Now I do, but when we were sitting around the dinner table, and everybody, I always felt like I was with a bunch of militants because they all could, like, you know, jab at each other and have fun doing that, and I would cry.
Oh, what did they mean by that, do you think?
Well, "Oh, great child of the universe," because I did a lot of self-development things, and you know, and I sort of wore my emotions on my sleeve, so...
Yes, well, you and I really resonate then, and the problem is that for people who are sensitive, I think it's particularly hard when others project their own discomfort onto us, and that's really what it sounds like they were doing with you, was it made them uncomfortable because they weren't facing themselves as much, and they weren't being as open or honest about their emotions as you. And I think that was a lot the same in my family, too, although because it wasn't acceptable to be direct about what we wanted, you know, I found ways that were probably annoying, such as pouting or going into sort of black cloud moods like my mother and sulking. You know, I would be indirect, or I would send out barbs when I got a chance, because it was the only way I knew how to defend myself and still maintain some semblance of truth.
I do, you know, I did that same thing. I didn't do the pouting and stuff, but I more or less became invisible until every once in a while I could get a zinger out. And
yes.
And you know what? When I did that, I would feel guilty.
Well, of course, it doesn't really help. One thinks it does, and where it's like sort of striking out with a claw, as a cat would do. And in the moment, it relieves some stress. But then the guilt comes in afterwards, and it amplifies the problem and certainly doesn't win you points with your siblings.
Yeah. And then you have to deal with all the nonsense of the guilt, you know.
That's right. Then you've got the guilt on top of the hurt.
I know. Well, you know, Eileen, you were the baby of the family, and your oldest brother, David, you sort of bonded, and you tell a great story about going swimming with your siblings, and David wasn't there. Can you tell us why that was significant in your life, why David not being there was so significant?
Well, there were several things that were significant. First of all, it was actually the first time I can remember being invited to join the middle four siblings, who were pretty much a clan unto themselves. They sometimes were paired off in twos and twos, but David and I were the bookends on the outside of that family cluster. And because he was 10 and a half years older, he really functioned as my protector. I suppose we had nothing to really compete with against. So there was that aspect, and there was a certain kind of natural organic symmetry, both in our positions in the family, but also our personalities. I think we both were similarly sensitive, and we also chose to go outside the family ultimately for our community. So what was important about that night of his not coming was that I was going to have to deal on my own, and my great big protector wasn't there, most likely because he was too old at that point. He was probably at a summer dance or out to a party or sailing and under the moonlight or something.
Yeah, he was moving into teenage.
He was already a late teen, because if I was 9, he was already 19 or 20. So I did climb up this mountain on Mount Desert Island with my four immediately older siblings. And, you know, my sister Abby loves an adventure, and she loves going barefoot to this day. And so I think, as my recollection was, that they'd only brought two bananas and a few flashlights, maybe some water, and we ended up climbing up this mountain through a very foggy atmosphere as the sun went down. And when we finally reached the pond at the top of the mountain, they all jumped in with glee and swam around, but I felt too scared that I was unprotected, and who knows, even a bear might come along. And we only had two bananas, and I wished my brother was there, because he would have brought more.
Oh, that's really good.
Yeah, it was fun.
You mentioned Mount Desert Island, and of course I call it Mount Desert Island, and I've been to the Abby Aldrich Rockefeller gardens that are just beautiful, and these were gardens that your grandmother created, and your grandmother died before you were born, but you had a dream about your grandmother in your late 20s. I think it was in your late 20s.
Yes, it was in my late 20s. You have great memory. And Well, there's so much to say about my grandmother. I actually dedicated the book in part to her, as you may know, along, of course, with my husband.
Mm-hmm.
But I was in a wilderness area in Idaho on the day that my oldest uncle, John D. Rockefeller III, died in a car crash. And, of course, in those days we had no cell phones. I was with a friend, had no way of knowing anything bad had happened. But that night I had a significant dream, the first ever, about my grandmother, who died 4 years before I was born. And in the dream, grandmother came to me in her long white gloves and her long pearls and her hat and a dress and kind of stumpy legs, as I recall in pictures. And in the dream, she took my elbow and walked around the inside of the cottage. It was the caretaker's cottage in her day, which had since been given to me as a house by my parents, as a summer house. And she showed me the Japanese prints and the Arthur Davies watercolors that she, in real life, had collected and which, in real life, were still on the walls. But she said to me in the dream, "Eileen, dear, now this house is yours now, and you may change the pictures in whatever way you wish." Well, I woke up and saw that this was a, you know, sometimes you get that feeling you've just had a very important dream.
Yeah, it's sort of like almost like it shakes you.
It shakes you. It does. And it shook me in a number of ways. First of all, I thought, oh my gosh, I've just had a visitation by my grandmother. She's just given me a significant metaphorical permission that I can choose whatever I want to do in my life. And, you know, nobody older had taken my arm that way and said, "You can do whatever you want to do." So that was significant. But then I heard a helicopter overhead, and suddenly it dawned on me, a completely random other thought: I wonder if something's wrong in my family. Are they trying to find me? Well, three days later, I came out of the wilderness, went straight to the telephone booth, such a different time, called my mother, and she said, "I'm so glad you called, but I'm so sorry to tell you that your Uncle John died." And it was, you know, three nights before, it was the same night that I had that dream.
It's kind of freaky, isn't it?
Yes, it was. It was as if it, somehow in his passing, I don't know, I have no explanation for the connection, but there was some kind of a connection in his passing that she came to me.
Eileen, I know that that was a turning point in your life, and we have to go to a break, so I would love to hear more about that. Can you hold on for just a minute, and then
sure.
We'll come back in about 2 minutes.
Okay, fine.
Thank you.
Yep. In times like these, violence in our schools is a reality, so it's important to know how to prevent such tragedies from happening. Talk to your kids. Explain to them the dangers of weapons at school, and tell them that if they see a student with a weapon or even hear someone talking about having one, they need to report it immediately. Tell them if something doesn't look right or seem right to you, speak up. Get to know who your child is spending time with and where they are at all times. If you notice that your child has sudden mood or behavior changes, or seems to always be angry or sad, talk to a teacher, administrator, or medical professional. Be a role model for them and settle your own conflicts without resorting to violence. Schools should be a safe place for our children. We all need to work together to keep it that way. Let's put an end to these tragedies. Ask your school to adopt an anti-violence program. Visit ncpc.org to learn more on how to keep our children safe. That's ncpc.org.
A message from the U.S. Department of Justice, National Crime Prevention Council, and the Ad Council.
Start a new chapter in your life called Retirement at the Hickman. Put aside the worries of home ownership, taking care of the lawn, raking leaves, and shoveling snow, and take advantage of living in the heart of the borough of Westchester in a gorgeous park-like setting on historic Quaker Hill. Enjoy fabulous farm-fresh meals with friends in a lovely dining room or al fresco on the beautiful terrace. Personal care is in place as the need need arises, and you can truly be home to stay. Give them a call at 484-999-0523 or visit their website at thehickman.org. Find out why The Hickman is dignity, diversity, and distinction at its best.
Toys R Us has all the toys kids want, all in one easy place. Our Black Friday sale continues now through Saturday with hundreds of doorbusters, including new doorbusters starting Friday, 5 a.m. while supplies last, like Monster High Ghouls Rule Dolls, just $9.99. Plus, it's our biggest tablet sale ever with incredible deals on over 20 tablets starting at just $49.99. Make all their wishes come true at Toys R Us.
Limit one per guest. Exclusions apply. Visit Toys R Us for details.
Okay, we're back with the Friday Happy Hour with Anne-Marie Kelly and Eileen Rockefeller-Growald. Eileen, we were just talking about the dream that you had and how it was really a turning point in your life.
Yeah.
After that happened, what did you do to start being your own person? You know, sometimes, as women, we get that sort of push, but then we don't know what to do with it. How did you make that start for yourself?
Wow, well, I wish I could claim such credit for all of it. I suppose the one thing I can claim credit for, and it's thanks to my mother's example, is that she believed in the power of therapy, and I got very interested in, I actually contemplated becoming a therapist for a while, but a transactional analysis therapist or Jungian, and I studied transactional analysis and Gestalt therapy, and from there I joined a group and found that group work was actually much more powerful, impactful, and expeditious than individual work. And the reason I think groups are so important is that, to me, the image that I hold for the power of groups is it's like any one of us throws the mirror of ourselves down on the floor, it crashes into thousands of pieces, and anyone else in the room will see a piece of themselves in that shard.
Hmm. Oh, that's interesting.
Yes, because truly, when you get right down to it, to the core emotions, we're all the same. We have different architecture, we have different circumstances, but the core of humanity, the emotions that drive us, and the responses, the feelings that come from responses, the feeling level is what we share with everyone.
Well, you know, Eileen, that's so true. I know I shared with you through email that I went to a private high school locally to Westchester. It was in Villanova. And I was the one who was always looking to see what was wrong with me, because it looked like everybody else was doing just great.
Yeah.
And, and because I was middle class and I went to school with many girls who were very wealthy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I thought, oh, geez, if I only had money, I went through all that stuff, then I would be okay. Only to find out, and there's still a core of my alums who get together regularly, only to find out years later that some of those girls who seemed like they were the happiest went home to situations that were, you know, I went home to a situation that maybe wasn't happy, but I didn't feel unsafe. They went home, some of them, to unsafe situations. Mm. So this many years later, we can still talk about, like, as that comes out, and you're absolutely right, it comes down to what is at the core of you, and sharing those feelings makes a huge difference in finding out that it doesn't, you know, like the exterior stuff doesn't matter as much as the interior stuff.
Well, that's right. In fact, one of the phrases I've often said in my book talks is that net worth is not as important as self-worth.
Absolutely. Yep.
And, you know, so much of our society is focused on the material and tells us that we need to have a TV in every room or two cars, etc. And yet what really fills us up is the experience of being loved, of loving ourselves, of having time with those who we love. And this certainly is the season for thinking about those
things.
That's
really true. Yeah. And you know what, Eileen, on that same point, When I was on your blog, I read something that I personally found so interesting. And you were talking about something, and you said that you told a friend, in looking back on your past, love was all around me, even when I hadn't seen it.
Yes.
And I wondered, was that, were you talking about your siblings? And what made you start to see it when you finally realized it?
Yeah, I'm really glad you asked that question, Anne-Marie. I didn't actually mean what you thought. What I do mean by love is all around me is something I've come to understand in my continuation of spiritual group work, and that is that it has to do with nature. It has to do with the Mother Earth all around us. That, as you know from walking the trails on Mount Desert Island or in Westchester, Pennsylvania, wherever, when you're in nature, there are no judges. The trees aren't sitting there wagging their branches and saying you've been bad or they didn't like what you did. They're simply standing, and the leaves are waving, perhaps at you, perhaps not. And you can kind of take it whatever way you wish. But what is love? The true base, the absolute most important kind of love is unconditional love. And I feel unconditional love from nature. I mean, look what we're doing to it. And yet we can walk out in the woods. You might argue, well, perhaps that's why we're seeing the typhoons and hurricanes and all the other things. There could be retribution. I don't believe it's any personalized retribution, because I can walk out on any given day. Storms will happen. That's a larger global thing. But where it comes up close and personal, I feel love from the rocks and the grass and the trees and the wind and the rain. There's something about nature that is very, very therapeutic and supportive. So that's the basis of what I meant in combination with the love I have and the support I have from my friends and family.
Mm. Well, I have to agree with you, because that's my spouse and I often, we do a lot of hiking, and it's the thing that keeps us coming back to Acadia and to the, you know, that whole experience on Mount Desert Island.
Yeah.
One of the things, Eileen, that you were saying, it took you 6 years to write your memoir.
Right.
And I wondered, would that be something that you would suggest to, you know, there's so many of us that are struggling still to find our authentic selves and get in touch with that. Would you recommend that as, like, sort of, not necessarily a therapy, but as a way of getting stuff out and making that connection to them, to yourself?
Well, for me, writing has been essential since the time I was 8 years old. And giving the 19 book talks I've given since I saw you, and 13 interviews, it has really brought it home to me that I'm probably a compulsive writer. You know, I've written over 100 journals since I was 8, and I'm 61 now. And I also, in addition to writing journals, I wrote poetry from the time I was 8. In fact, I received some of those poems from my third grade spelling and word study teacher as a result of some of the publicity I've received.
Wow.
And she wrote me a letter and sent me poems. One was called The Journey of Life, that I wrote when I was 8 years old.
Oh, my goodness, how prophetic.
I know. It was just totally amazing to me. But in terms of other people, I guess I wouldn't narrow it to writing. Any form of self-expression, whatever feels right to an individual. There are times when I listen to music and I dance, and that feels great. Other times I take a walk. Other times I have a bath. But if you're looking for ways to explore self, and, you know, certainly we find mirrors that are more accurate in our friends, and hopefully we all find friends who are good listeners, but they're not always around or available. And so if writing is something one enjoys, then I would say go for it. And I used to like to use journals that did not have any lines. I love the blank page. And it was so that I could draw if I felt like drawing, or I could write in large print or in small print, whatever I wanted. I think the important thing is to give yourself full permission for self-expression in whatever way you're drawn to in that moment.
Well, that's for me, it's writing, but it's also some of the things. It's that walking and doing things. And so, and for other people I know, it would be torture to tell them to pick up, to take pen to paper.
Right, I know.
But, something that you said in your book that when I first read it, I thought you said you were a weaver of yarns and a connector. And when I first read that, a connector of people, and when I first read that, I thought weaver of yarns meant stories, but you actually work with your hands and you sold things, right?
Oh, I actually was a professional weaver in my 20s. I had shows and I did commissions. I loved working with the physical, wools and other yarns, synthetic yarns too, and cottons. And I made rugs and blankets and wall hangings, and I even did things I called rag tapestries. And I went under the name of Eileen McGrath in those days when I was trying to go incognito and explore my creative side of that aspect of my creative side. So, yes, I really was a weaver of real yarns. Now I'm a weaver of yarns as in stories.
Yeah, so that first thing is true now, but back then, who'd have thunk it, Eileen, that you were actually a weaver?
Well, that's true. Who would have thunk it? I hadn't thought about it until I was probably in my 40s. And then as I looked back, the decade of my 30s, I started the Institute for the Advancement of Health, which was a pioneering organization in the mind-body health field. And one of the great advantages of being a Rockefeller is you do have convening power. I'm able to call people up and get a call back. Mm. And I'm able to organize a group of people around a subject. And so I hired someone to help me do the details, but I organized and found all of the sort of heads of the subfields of mind-body health. For example, psychoneuroimmunology, psychopharmacology, biofeedback, etc. And it turned out that these people had been mavericks out on their own. They didn't have a community. And what was keeping them from really getting the serious attention of medical professionals was that they didn't have the strength of their community and the diversity within it. So that was a wonderful thing to be able to be a connector of.
Well, that's a pretty neat thing, and you're right. And you do a lot of work around emotional intelligence also, and that's part of that whole process, right?
It is. That sort of grew out of mind-body health. We were looking then at children and how might children be impacted in their health by the mind-body connection. And certainly I knew that as a child, having felt so scared of failing that I often did fail. And Dan Goleman, who wrote Emotional Intelligence, has now shown us that there's a primitive place in the brain called the amygdala, which when we get scared, it just totally shuts off our ability to remember.
Those amygdala hijackings.
Exactly.
Yep.
And now I understand why I failed those tests. Today I don't feel so scared. So, but yes, I've been a co-founder of the Collaborative for Academic Social and Emotional Learning, or CASEL is the acronym. And this organization out of University of Illinois in Chicago is promoting social and emotional learning programs in schools in every state across America. And what they've shown is that children who have good social and emotional skills perform 11% better on their academic scores.
That's oh, my goodness. I didn't know that.
It's great to have some of the science behind this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Eileen, there is so much more to talk with you about, and unfortunately we have to go. But for my listeners, I want you to know that in keeping with what Eileen was just talking about, she moved her whole family to a farm at some point where they had no electricity, and they homeschooled, and you're just going to have to buy her book in order to hear the rest of that story. Eileen, can you tell our listeners where they can get your book and about your blog and all of that,
sure,
where they can connect with you?
Well, thank you, Anne-Marie. You could go to Eileen Rockefeller. EileenRockefeller.com is my website. And you could also look on Amazon for Being a Rockefeller, Becoming Myself, or just plug in Eileen Rockefeller and you'll get whatever information you need. And I hope my readers will enjoy my stories. Many people say that they read them like bedtime stories because the chapters are short, and some have read the book all the way through without stopping. So whatever
kind of
reader you are, I hope you'll enjoy them. And Anne-Marie, it's such a pleasure to talk with you about all of this.
Well, thank you, Eileen.
It's so important to find our communities and to find our own sense of self-worth, because in becoming ourselves, we can best actualize our potential.
Well, you're absolutely right, and this is, and thank you so much for being my guest today. And I've read your book, so I know that you have a lot of chapters, but you're right, they are all doable. So you can just, if you're on the train or if you're standing in line someplace, you can just open the book, read a chapter, and then go on your way. So, Eileen, thank you, and I'll be in touch. I would love to see your garden, and thank you again for coming today.
Oh, thanks so much for inviting me. I enjoyed it.
Thank you. Bye.
Goodbye.